It's 1849 and Brigham Young is cranky. Let's be honest, he's straight up cranky all the time, but this particular time, he was big mad about the honorable, self-sacrificing men of the Mormon battalion. Here's the thing. I was going to write this episode about something completely different, but then I was looking in Juanita Brooks's papers and found a folder of her notes on the Mormon battalion, and she chronicles a bunch of times that Brigham Young just shat all over his faithful soldiers. And so it got me curious. What was happening here? And why would Brigham Young turn on his own guys like this?
You all remember the Mormon battalion, the 500 stout volunteers. Stripling warriors, if you will, who sacrificed leaving their families on basically no pay to walk by foot to California to fight in Uncle Sam's pretend war so that other Mormons could illegally encroach on Indian lands protected by the Indian Intercourse Act of June of 1834.
Yes, those sweet cinnamon bears. Let's see what their loyal prophet and leader allegedly said about them. Brigham told John D. Lee that the battalion boys were made up of the lowest scrapings of hell. Very Brigham Young quote there. And we're going to talk about this later, the summer quarters, because John D. Lee is basically in charge there. So they have winter quarters, they have summer quarters. And you're going to hear about that, you know, a little bit in the next quote. So here's the quote from Juanita Brooks's notes, quote, "There has been no man in this church that has done as much for the soldier, wives, and poor widows as Brother Lee has but myself." And Juanita notes Lee is quoting from Brigham Young talking about himself. "In fact, he has run and exposed himself enough to wear him out. Now to oppress and sacrifice him, it cannot be done, and those that use the influence against him will go down to hell, and I know that the lowest scrapings of hell were in the battalion. Notwithstanding, there were some good men among them. The soldiers' wives had lied and tattled about me and Brother Rockwood and said that we have cheated and wronged them out of their money and thereby poisoned and soured the feelings of their husbands." Blame it on the women, of course. They're the liars. John D. Lee being a cheat. What a terrible lie. Slander. Back to John D. Lee. "Insomuch that they give way to the same spirit and commence finding fault with their brethren who have done all they could to sustain the soldiers' families while their husbands were gone. Great God, could women trammel me in this manner? No, all their counsel and wisdom, although there are many good women, don't weigh as much with me as the weight of a fly turd. Excuse me for my vulgarity. It is not common for me to use such language," says Brigham Young. I don't talk like this normally.
No, definitely not common.
"Excuse me for my vulgarity. It's not common for me to use such language, but I know of no language to mean to suit the case before us. It is not a woman's place to counsel her husband, and the moment a man follows a woman, he is led astray and will go down to hell unless he retracts his steps." Yeah, I mean, I feel like even though Brigham, you know, John D. Lee's writing this down and bragging about how beloved he is, which he always did, yeah, Brigham Young thinks I'm awesome. This sounds pretty accurate to Brigham Young's speech patterns, I'd say.
He was terrified of women. They're always trying to trammel him.
Always trammel the poor Brigham. He's really the victim of women. He's the real victim here.
But this isn't the first part of the story, though, because we need to back up to 1846. The saints there are snuggled down in winter quarters, and the detachments of the battalion are trying to return home. Brigham Young has ordered John D. Lee to travel to Santa Fe from winter quarters to collect the payments that were due to the soldiers from the federal government. Because remember, the Mormons weren't just playing for Uncle Sam's team because the Star-Spangled Banner is on a loop in their hearts. John Doyle is supposed to go get that shiny government cash back to winter quarters. But, interestingly, there's accusations that he pocketed or stole the money and was not honest in his accounting.
What?
No, I swear, we beat Johnny back.
Brigham Young says I'm the best man that ever lived.
So, this is, of course, John D. Lee we're talking about here. This whole thing was supposed to be confidential, and according to Juanita Brooks, it was also kind of dangerous. She says, quote, "Part of the money that Lee received failed to reach the families for whom it was intended." But she believed that Lee was probably not at fault.
Agree to disagree, Juanita.
Oh, but this is serious then. We're pushing back on Juanita.
Here's the thing. Juanita had a soft spot for him, but John D. Lee is accused in the massacre later of not being honest. And if you follow his life, it's a constant theme for him. So either John D. Lee is not honest, or John D. Lee is just a victim a lot.
It's not a bug. It's a friggin' feature.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Brian, do you know what the D in D. Michael Quinn stands for?
I feel like it should be documents, but that's not it.
Sounds like someone needs to read his memoir. After D. Michael Quinn's death in April 2021, his children found his remarkable unpublished memoir in his home and entrusted Signature Books with its publication. Relying on his journals, primary research, and reminiscences, Quinn shares his life story as few have heard it. From his father's hiding of his true name and Mexican identity, to his upbringing by his abusive grandmother, and seriously, like, it's crazy, to his choice to closet his homosexuality, to his undying commitment to his faith and its history. From the age of 9, Quinn felt convicted he would one day serve as an apostle of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He chose the path he believed would take him there, eventually living as a straight LDS family man in a mixed orientation marriage. In the 1970s, he became a BYU professor and eventually one of Mormonism's most promising, prolific, and respected historians. But his uncompromising commitment to total honesty about his religion's history, along with his homosexuality, set him on a collision course with the church leaders and the end of his seemingly idyllic Mormon life. Throughout his telling, Quinn unflinchingly opens up about his feelings and experiences that shaped his enigmatic life. Chosen Path, a memoir by D. Michael Quinn, new from Signature Books. Get it from Benchmark Books, or we'll tell everyone you prefer endnotes to footnotes.
Okay, it's time to go back to the other insults about the battalion in Juanita's notes, because there's more where that came from. Obviously, like chips, not buffalo chips, Brigham could never stop at just one insult. Straight from the prophet governor himself, quote, "The battalion boys, since returning from the army, have become idle, lazy, and indolent, and with a very few exceptions, dissipated, indulging in vice and wickedness." Damn, dissipated. That's savage.
More and more, I'm reading this, and I'm like, what is he talking about? I've only ever heard about the great sacrifices of these guys, right? The reenactments, the historic things, the beautiful gospel music that shows images of them marching.
Their hickory pants.
Their hickory pants. Susan's wash tub. Their great commitment to the gospel. We recreate this stuff in Mormon Trek, so what gives?
Well, here's another. This comment was recorded on February 18, 1849. Quote, "At 10, the citizens of the valley assembled for public meetings in the old fort. President Brigham Young and others spoke to them upon the principles of individual duties towards one another as saints of God. The remarks were appropriate and tended to aid in bringing a revival, which was much needed among the people, especially the soldiers. For since returning home from the army, the most of them have become idle, lazy, and indolent, indulging in vice, corrupting the morals of the young females."
Oh no. What vices are we talking about when it comes to corrupting young females? Well, it was reported that, quote, "six of the soldier boys cut a Spanish rusty by riding into the fort with a young lady sitting in the saddle before and the man behind with his arms around the woman."
A Spanish rusty? How dare they? Jeez, this is getting a little PG up in here. Permission to rename soaking a Spanish rusty?
Absolutely denied. Hard deny. Sorry about that. Quote, one of the men was sawing on the violin. This they called Spanish manners of politeness. All the soldiers involved were voted by the High Council to be cut off from the church and fined $25. That's right, folks. A woman riding in front of a man on a horse or doing a Spanish rusty meant excommunication in 1849. And apparently, this was a practice from the Californians, which was very similar and seen as very bad manners.
I don't care who you are. I don't care what your belief system is. Victorian indignation will never not be funny. It just is. I have to think the Smash Brothers back in Boston are just giggling up a storm. They're getting excommunicated for this nonsense. There weren't even any stained sheets. Okay. All these bad battalion disses weren't always just Brigham being ungrateful, because there were some rough characters in the battalion.
There were plenty of rough characters in the 1846 council, cough, cough, James Emmett, cough, cough, hack, hack, Porter Rockwell, hack, hack, as well.
That's a fair point, but here's a good example of the battalion guys Brigham was referring to. We'll let Ms. Juanita bring us in here. Quote, the name Thomas S. Williams, one of the colorful characters caught in the Western Mormon movement, appears again and again in the Mormon diaries and histories. During his early life in Nauvoo, and later as he marched west with the Mormon battalion, Williams gained the reputation of being a clever thief. One of his contemporaries declared that he made his brag that he had stolen everything from a hen on a roost to a steamboat engine.
He's the guy we mentioned last episode, too, who was on John D. Lee's hunting team and said to have been cheating.
Tommy Boy's back. Dale Morgan quotes William Chandless as saying, quote, indeed he, Williams, had raised stealing to the level of one of the fine arts. While at Nauvoo, he stole, one Sunday, the whole machinery of a small sawmill and sunk it into the Mississippi till all search was given over. A yoke of cattle he concealed in a hollow haystack, but the necessity of opening to take in water gave the stake some queer look that betrayed him. Above all, as a horse thief, he was not second even to an Indian.
Could have done without that last bit of racism, but since he brought it up, this is what this episode has now become. So now, when you hear in the Utah period about all these Indian thieves stealing from the poor Mormons, remember that the Mormons had their fair share of thieves, and they were proud of it. And that's why we decided to talk about this today, because as we go on throughout this period in Mormonism, you're going to hear a lot about thieving Indians and how it justifies all kinds of terrible, terrible things that will follow. But you know what, y'all? The Mormons were often ignoring the giant beam in their own eyes. So today, we're talking about Mormon thieves.
Lost sounds rumble in the heavens, look down at the end of the world. Chunk it forwards, hold on to something, make some noise, it's the silence of earth. Reaching for dreams, stereo screens, nothing answers the call. Satellite cries, nobody dies, the fountain is the plug in the wall. Where the hell are all of my friends?
Did you know that, according to historians Roger Lanius and John Hallwiss, in their book Cultures in Conflict, that Mormons brought crime wherever they went? Quote, shortly after the Mormons arrived in Hancock County and before much political antagonism had developed, residents in some townships noted a significant increase in theft. Livestock, food, clothes, and other items were taken, and the Mormons were immediately blamed. I always heard that no one wanted the Mormons around because they couldn't handle the truth of the gospel, but this is telling me something else. Not only did many Gentiles conclude the Mormons were thieves, they believed stealing was, quote, officially sanctioned by the church.
How much it was sanctioned by the church is up for debate. We'll dig into it here a little bit, but here's how I like to look at it. Crime has always existed in Mormon communities, just as it appears now.
I know, so there's like this huge scourge of Mormon exceptionalism that was like bred into me at an early age. You know, the idea that Mormons were the most interesting, the most special, the most fascinating, peculiar creatures in the world. And then when you lose your faith or become angry at the church, it's really easy for that same Mormon exceptionalism to turn into like, we are particularly bad. Mormons were the most evil, the most dishonest, the most wicked folks. And the reality is, and this is a really disappointing reality to me as a person who wants to try to maintain some faith in my heritage, Mormons are just as effed up as everyone else. There's nothing really exceptional about the doctrine or theology that can rescue Mormons from being human. And I think that, to me, that's the like most disappointing thing. Like, the doctrine is supposed to elevate people, but it doesn't.
So before we go any further, we've brought on our friend and fairy godmother of the podcast, Joe Geisner, to tell us just how deep the crimes go. According to Joe, they go all the way to the top. And by the top, we mean Joseph Smith. So let's let Lindsay bring us in with our interview of Joe Geisner. Brother, where have you been? There ain't nobody, I'm a lonely man.
Well, hello again, Joe Geisner. We've called you the fairy godmother of the podcast, if that's true, in more ways than people know. You've been my history dealer for a long time, feeding me documents and stuff that has helped me on my quest. So it's always good to talk to you.
Well, speaking of that, in Mike Quinn's new memoir, which I've gotten a sneak peek of, because you just did the advertisement for it with Brian, Mike actually talks about the Mormon Underground, and it was an amazing phenomenon. And that is how we operated. And I came in late in the Mormon Underground. You got Mike Quinn or Gerald Sandra Tanner, Mike Marquardt, you know, those kinds of people who made, and oh, Scott Fallring, you know, they were really the impetus behind that. Their grandpa's bookstore. And it was quite incredible. So I've sort of, maybe because I am a late comer into that, it wasn't till the late 80s that I got into that I feel the need to share. And you are amazing to share with, because you then get the word out. And that was the purpose for that Mormon Underground, was to get the information, you know, that typescript being taken of William Clayton's diaries from Lyndon Cook's office back at BYU, and then being taken down to Grandpa's bookstore, and then copies were made and they went everywhere. You know, that changed what we knew about William Clayton and Joseph Smith. So I see it as important. So thank you very much for the compliment.
Well, it's a big compliment, because you really are one of the coolest. I don't know how many times a month, you know, we've got this whole network of nerds like us, right? Very specific nerds. We're always tracking down leads. And I can't tell you how many times I'm like, check with Geisner. He's got it. I promise you, he's got it. Your archive must be incredible.
It's fun, you know, and the beauty of digitization to be able to share, you know, back in the day, it was photocopies, and I was having people make photocopies of things for me. And that was very expensive back doing that, where, you know, now we can digitize everything. I've got my printer scanner right next to my computer. And I just, every time I get anything that's hard copy, boy, I put it right in and make a digital copy. So.
Well, your good filing practices are the gain of all of our listeners. So that's what I was wanting to talk to you about today. We were talking about, I was telling you about the episode I was writing, Mormon Thieves, and you're like telling me all kinds of stuff. And I was like, stop, stop, stop. Let's just get that on the podcast. So tell us what you're going to talk about today.
Oh, well, you know, as Brian's intro said, that we would talk about how stealing, thieving, those kinds of things went to the very top. And it is my opinion. And again, I want to be clear, it is my opinion from the evidence. As I've looked at the body of evidence, that's the conclusion I came. And I just wanted to share that with people. Now, again, everybody can come to a different conclusion. And you quote from this, and so I may be, you know, re-saying what you've already said, but I do think it's important that Roger Launius and John Hollis, and by the way, John Hollis was a non-Mormon, or is, actually, he's still alive, is a non-Mormon historian at, I think, University of Southern Illinois, and has created, along with Stan Kimball, when he was alive, created this incredible Mormon collection and in Southern Illinois University. And Roger Lanius, who is, I always called him the Mike Quinn of the RLDS and now Community of Christ. And speaking of, here's a little plug for my forthcoming volume, Mormon History, Writing Mormon History 2. Roger has written a chapter for that, like Will Bagley and Mike Quinn wrote a chapter for the first volume. Roger has written a chapter, and it's very good, very personal, and very touching. But anyway, the two write, the amount of Mormon theft is impossible to determine, since some stealing by others was undoubtedly blamed on the saints. Nor can Joseph Smith's involvement be established with any certainty, despite what some memoirs in this section imply. Certain Mormon raiders may have felt they had Smith's approval when in fact they did not. In any case, the evidence of Mormon theft is substantial, and that activity caused some non-Mormons and townships near Nauvoo to oppose the saints. I would go so far as I think that you can add Joseph Smith's name to that easily with the body of evidence. It's substantial.
So let's dig into that a little bit, because, you know, we're now on the podcast, we're in the Utah period. And, you know, like I mentioned in the podcast, it just really irks me that the narrative that we still hold on to, especially as Mormons, but, you know, in the West with history, is like, well, it was a really complicated time. There were a lot of Native Americans that were stealing, and, you know, Brigham dealt with it by being very kind. And but then you find out that Mormons have been stealing all along. And I think it just kind of makes me mad, because it's the way that we look at this hypocrisy and how we look at, you know, stealing, depending on who's doing it, and how that justifies certain reactions and responses and outcomes. And so, you know, when we were talking about this, you did talk about how this was not just Brigham Young. This goes back to Joseph Smith.
Well, thanks, Lindsay, because that's exactly you've given me the perfect opening. Bill Shepherd, William Shepherd, you use him in this podcast. He's written four articles, all basically published in the John Whitmer Historical Journal, which is a fantastic historical journal, going back, well, to that first one about the stealing. But then he did follow-ups to that. And one of the things, as we were talking about, and by the way, his specialty is on the Hodge brothers. And those articles, if anybody takes the time to read those, and they're all available, as far as I know, on the internet for free. He gave a Sunstone presentation about 3 or 4 years before the paper was published. And he blamed Brigham Young for the stealing that the Hodge brothers had done at the Mennonite home, and were they were murdered, and the family, you know, members, some of them were murdered, some were injured severely. And then two of the Hodge brothers were hung by that. And just a part of that, just to let you know, the William Hodges was developmentally disabled. And Bill always said to me that William Hodge held a special place for him because he was developmentally disabled. And Bill had worked actually in an institution there in Wisconsin. The tragedy of all of that, you know, because they, you know, they hung him for that, and probably did not play much of a part. But getting back to Brigham Young about that, so Bill put the blame on Brigham Young for being the mastermind, essentially, of the river rats, the Nauvoo River Rats, which were the Hodge brothers and many of those other people that you talk about. And they did literally live down on the Mississippi River. So he changed that in the published article. He changed that and put none of the blame actually on Brigham Young, but all of it on the river rats. And then And I conflate. It may be in the article, but Bill said to me that he had come to the conclusion in doing that research on the Hodge brothers that Brigham Young was actually trying to clean up Nauvoo, and that Joseph Smith, who Brigham, as people, as you point out, I believe that Bill has no affiliation to the Brighamites. He and his family are followers of James Strang, and so they're Strangites. And so Bill felt very strongly in telling me that he actually came to the conclusion during that research that Joseph Smith was basically a crime boss. And from all of his research, which he did way more than I ever did, he read, thousands of documents and came to that conclusion. So that, I like how you say, that we always put the blame on Brigham Young. And yet Bill came to the conclusion that really it did start with Joseph Smith.
I have to say the organized crime thing is something I've been grappling with the last few years, because, you say that and it sounds reductive to what Mormonism is, because today to a lot of people, it's a faith, it's a religion. But, when I've dealt with certain fundamentalist modern day sects, like the Kingstons, for example, there's a good argument to be made that they're organized crime masquerading as a religion. And again, if you talk to those folks, they would be like, no, it's a faith. For a lot of the chapel folks on the ground, it's a faith, it's a practice, there's ritual, there's belief, there's, God is involved. And even with the leaders, but how it looks to, like the FBI perhaps, might allegedly be organized crime. And there is a very vibrant lens to look at Joseph Smith doing the same thing. It looks very similar.
I completely agree with you. And again, you make a perfect opening for my next comment. It's like we planned this, but we didn't.
That's the magic of you and the fairy godmother. That's your magic.
it's the looking at it from an outsider's perspective, maybe, but also I think as we become more educated in looking at it, as I was studying the Ohio period, particularly, and Ohio is probably my favorite period. One reason is because I think the beauty of Smith's theology, but not so much as, because Smith really didn't have much of a theology, but his desires and his expectations, his vision is so beautiful during most of the Kirtland period. There obviously are issues, but for much of the Kirtland period, you really get some beautiful ideas. But when you really jump into it, you start also seeing some of the other things. And that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit, if you don't mind, is because it does start before Nauvoo. It actually, in my opinion, starts, if you look at New York from a different perspective, Joseph Smith's money digging was stealing. It was stealing money from Josiah Stoll. It was stealing money from Martin Harris, convincing people that you can dig up buried treasure is a manner of stealing. And then when you get to Kirtland, I see it as a whole new level of stealing. You have Joseph Smith's friends. It's sort of troubling because you've got people like the Whitneys, who at the time Joseph Smith came into Kirtland, the Whitneys were probably the richest people in that area. They had a potash sawmill. They had a store. They owned two homes. Well, actually a home and then the apartment complex above the store. And when I read Mark Staker's book about Ohio, I figured out the amount of money, and this is now, 10 years ago that I read it, so my numbers could be off, but in my head, but it seemed to me that it was over $60,000 that Joseph Smith got from the Whitneys over that period of time. And by the time the Whitneys, I think, left for Nauvoo, or maybe it was when they left, no, yeah, it had to have been, but by the time they left for Nauvoo, Joseph Smith actually, in turn, had to loan them money in order to get to Nauvoo. $60,000 in that, you know, the 1830s would be over $2 million in today's money. That's just mind-boggling to me. You have the tanners who come in, and they are very rich. Same thing happens. Joseph Smith sees them pouring in, you know, this family coming in with tons of money and gets money from them. The Johnsons, who are one of my favorite families to study in Mormonism, I just think that John Tanner and his wife, can't think of her name now, but she was the one who had the arthritis in her hand. You know, they had a huge family that has interesting dynamics between Smith and them. They and all very intelligent people. The Johnsons owned an amazing amount of property in Hiram and bought the French property in Kirtland so the temple could be built. And again, by the time Joseph Smith was done with them, John Johnson refused to give up the French Inn because that's all he had left. He had nothing left. He had given everything to Joseph Smith. And one of my favorite stories is, and it was Rick Grunder's research into this, that Jacob Meyer, which is spelled M-Y-E-R, he owned substantial property and had businesses up in northern Ohio. So in 1842, Meyer sold everything and got $10,000. Just coincidentally, in April, shortly after Meyer did this, Joseph Smith received a revelation about paying off. God commanded the saints to pay off all their debt. And because they had just closed down the Law of Consecration United Order, because it turned into a fiasco, there was all this debt that had accumulated. And so Joseph Smith received Section 104, today's Section 104, which was Section 98 in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, that Joseph Smith then sent Zebedee Coltrane to talk with Jacob Meyer, because Jacob Meyer was flush with cash to pay off all of these debts that had been created. That when you take advantage of those who are closest to you, your believers, there's a whole nother level of mindset in that to me. As I started looking at this pattern, I became really disturbed by it. And then I jumped, you know, and I had to do a review for a book on Missouri. I really jumped in to Missouri and was in contact with Stephen LeSueur and having, you know, him go over my stuff, but who wrote the 1838 Mormon War in Missouri, which is still by far the best book on the subject. But I think I had mentioned to Stephen, I said, it was so weird to me when you look at 1836, 37, the Mormons had gotten their own county, pretty relative peace after the tumultuous experience of Jackson County. And Jackson County is a whole nother strange thing in and of itself, but they were getting along with people outside of their county for the most part. They also had been abiding the agreement that the Mormons had made that they would not settle in surrounding areas, that they would stay in their county in Northwest Missouri. And so Joseph Smith gets there in January of 1838. By March or April, he's already preaching about getting what's due from the Gentiles, like fleecing the Gentiles, I think, or is what it's called. And they had code words for like honey was sweet oil. And if you stole honey, that's what you call, you know, the Mormons called it sweet oil. If you stole a cow, that was a bear. And they had some other code words. I don't remember what they all are, but it's like, you know, seriously, this is where they're going. Lyman White. Okay, there was so much stuff in Far West that the Mormons had stolen, and they wanted to make sure that it didn't go back to each individual who had been stealing. So they hauled it all to Lyman White's like storage unit, essentially, that he had there in Far West. And he was the one who was charged with stealing in the trial when the Mormons were brought to trial there in Missouri. So, you know.
So let me ask about this. At the time, when all this is happening, let's talk about the theological underpinnings. They're justifying it. Obviously, like you said, there's this United Order of the Dead, the DNC that Joseph Smith has developed. But do we know how they're explaining it? Because I think that this is important. The thing that I've been learning about the Utah period over the last few years is how deep this idea of secret oaths within the priesthood went. I mean, it becomes localized and institutionalized. So you have local ward leaders for decades doing secret oaths amongst each other. And of course, they were all doing the prayer circles back then. You know, the men would do their sacred prayer circles. They would have their secret, we would call them secret combinations now. But it really does develop this culture of like brotherhood, secrecy, oaths, promises, scheming. So it's almost like this MLM of crime or secrecy or whatever you want to call the adjective for what it is, happening on a local level, scaling to a stake level, and then, you know, scaling to a branch and then to the whole church.
That's correct. Yes. I love your explanation, yours and Brian's, about this stake that was ultimately dissolved. Ramus, I think it's pronounced Ramus. I'm not sure. I can't remember if I pronounce it wrong. But anyway. There, you know, that they dissolve and turn it into a branch. And but your specific question is how does Joseph Smith explain it?
Yeah,
with his friends, meaning, I'm guessing. Yeah, that's you know, you've got to be a true believer. I look at particularly with the Johnson family. And the Whitney family, they gave up their teenage daughters to Joseph Smith. Now, I don't believe, as many people believe, Fawn Brody being one of them, that the tar and feathering that occurred in Hiram, Ohio, had to do with sexual, at least with Miranda Nancy Johnson, who then became Hyde, Orson Hyde's wife. I don't believe that she was off at school for quite a bit of the time the Smiths were there. And so anyway, I'm convinced that it was actually over land and which again, and money, and that's what it was. Joseph Smith said that he had received a revelation that a temple was to be built. And this would have been before, I think, the Kirtland Temple, if I remember correctly, not the Kirtland Temple. That it would have been built there in Hiram on a knoll as you face north out of the Johnson farm there. You look, there's a knoll there, and that's where Joseph Smith wanted to build the temple. And it was about getting all the money. So you got the Ryder family, who were big landowners. You got the Johnson family, and there are other families there. And so, yeah, this was, I see it as about money. And so when you've got a family, though, because by Nauvoo and the Johnson parents themselves, and so you do have John Johnson, who ultimately became disillusioned because he was down to the French inn. But before that, they were true believers. And, you know, and their own daughter then becomes one of Smith's wives and actually becomes basically a sex toy for him and his buddies in Nauvoo. But the Whitneys, you know, ultimately give up.
Explain that more to us. Explain what you mean by that.
By being a sex toy? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, she, you know, she lives with Willard Richards. There's all kinds of gossip about that. And the gossip comes from reliable people, such as Sarah Pratt. And it's one time, you know, and again, I don't have sources right in front of me over that, but Joseph Johnston and I were talking about, you know, the whole thing with that. And he's really the expert on Nauvoo, and that it was, you know, at the printing office, when she lived at the printing office with Willard Richards, men were seen coming and going nonstop, you know, to have sexual relations with her. And you know, Joseph Smith himself, you know, claimed her as one of his wives. And this is partly going on while Orson Hyde's on his mission, which, by the way, Joseph Smith sent him on. So that was not an uncommon thing either. I mean, we've got other, that's the thing, you know, we can talk about these specifics and in the stealing, the same thing we're going to talk about and have been talking about. I see a pattern. I see patterns in this. It's not just, oh, Joseph Smith got Jacob Meyer's money. after he receives a revelation. But it's the Tanners, and it's the Johnsons, and it's the Whitneys, and it's Martin Harris, and it's Josiah Stoll. And speaking of, you know, speaking of having some of these daughters, you got Joseph Smith having the two Stoll sisters, you know, when he's doing his treasure digging. You know, that was one of the things that came up in the trial, was that, you know, that he had had sexual relations, or at least one of the accusations. I shouldn't say trial, but the accusations. And the ghost of Will Bagley's haunting me for being too too specific and not about the wrong thing. Anyway, but yeah, so to me, Miranda Johnson is one of the tragic figures of Mormonism. This, she fits the pattern of an abused woman. And I don't believe that started with her family. I believe that started with the connection that, that the Johnson family made with the Smiths, and particularly Joseph Smith. Her story is tragic. But getting back to, they're true believers, and Joseph Smith's word is law. And we see that again in Nauvoo, that Joseph Smith, when you look at Joseph Smith, he's the mayor, he is the prophet, he is head of, he's lieutenant general. And how presumptuous is that? George Washington was the only person ever to be given the rank of lieutenant general. And Joseph Smith makes himself lieutenant general of the Nauvoo Legion. That's just mind-blowing. And all the other things he controlled, the shopping, one of the most coveted jobs was being postmaster in Nauvoo. So he made sure that only his friends, and you know, when the whole thing blew up about Nancy Rigdon, you know, one of the things was Sidney Rigdon becoming the postmaster for Nauvoo. The fallout of all that. A landowner. He was the most powerful of the land, you know, and I still think that's one of the reasons he wanted William Law's wife, was because William Law was the only person that stood up to Joseph Smith on any level when it came to power. And if he could have Jane Law, and he said, he told William Law that, you know, William Law could have her 50% of the time and Joseph Smith could have her for the other 50%, which William Law rejected. But this is the most powerful person, political. He controls the voting of Nauvoo. When you look at the stealing, it changes, I believe. And we'd forgot to, you know, Missouri is a whole nother thing, that Joseph Smith goes out on rides with the Danites and attends meetings with the Danites and speaks for the Danites. At times, the Adam Black thing, you know, where he goes there and threatens Adam Black, who is a judge, even. But the Mormons see him as an anti-Mormon, which he really wasn't, and threaten him to sign a statement that he wasn't an anti-Mormon and denounced the anti-Mormons, which he refused to do. And the stealing that goes on in Missouri because of that. And it all starts after Joseph Smith gets there. That's what my point was earlier, that, you know, once he gets there in January, everything changes. And that's when all the reports of the stealing and all of this oath, as you talk about, that continues to be pervasive in Utah. So we still have that in Nauvoo. And maybe it even takes a turn for even being on a more intense level with the oaths that were given at the Council of 50, the oaths that were given at the Holy Order. These are, and the Nauvoo Legion itself and the police force all take oaths, and all are Joseph Smith's own armies and law enforcement and do his bidding. And then when you've got the river rats, you know, that is the real criminal activity, who some of them ultimately become members of the Council of 50, you really take it at a different level. When the Hodge brothers were arrested, you have a complete shock And this occurs during Brigham Young's, as president of the Quorum of the Twelve. He's now basically leading the church. Technically, the Quorum of 12 is leading them, you know, the entire quorum, but de facto leader is Brigham Young. And Brigham Young turns the Hodge brothers over to law enforcement, and so they threaten Brigham Young's life, Irving Hodges particularly. And threatens to kill, I think he threatens to kill John Taylor as well, and also the police chief, back or sheriff, maybe a sheriff. And so there's no evidence, as Bill Shepherd points out, there's no evidence that Brigham Young ordered Hodges' death, but there are police connections to it, that it did happen. And the police are surrounding him as he's dying at Brigham Young's doorstep. And he, I believe he has the billy club of one of the police chief in his hands that he used to fight off the attackers. And he made it. And if you're ever in Nauvoo, he made it all the way from the river to Brigham Young's front porch, which is not an easy walk. It particularly being stabbed 4 or 5 times. And he made it all the way because they were hiding out, and that's where he was attacked. They were hiding out at the river, and there was cornfield, and he made it through the cornfield. And if I remember right, he got stabbed even in the cornfield, but made it up to the porch and bled out and died. And so, but these guys took oaths. And so William Smith is flipping out because he can't get the other Hodge brothers out of jail. And the other, there were ultimately, I believe, 2 other members of the gang that were released or escaped. They called it escaped. But the Hodge brothers stayed in prison. And then William, who was the developmentally disabled, and the other brother, were ultimately hung, and they were taken back over to Iowa and hung over there because that's where the crime was committed. William Smith was freaking out because that's not the way it had been done before. You know, they could show. And that's one of the interesting things with Thomas Ford is that I found he writes a letter. Or no, he writes it's a governor's statement. It's the 1844 governor's statement. So this is before, though, the assassination. I'm going to read the whole paragraph. It's a long, but so this is a proclamation of Governor Ford's, or a statement, actually, of Governor Ford's. It's called Message from the Governor in Relation to the Disturbances in Hancock County. And it was produced in 1844, so it could have actually even been written in 1843. It was asserted that Joseph Smith, the founder and head of the Mormon Church, has caused himself to be crowned and anointed King of the Mormons. And by the way, I think this is important to read because it's like, yeah, we've now found out that all these things that Ford is saying are true. So anyway, getting back to it, that he had embodied a band of followers called Danites who were sworn to obey him as God and to do his commands, murder and treason, not accepted, that he had instituted an order in the church whereby those who composed it were pretended to be sealed up to eternal life against all crimes, saving the shedding of innocent blood or consenting thereto. It's amazing that Ford pretty much has the second endowment words. That this order was instructed that no blood was innocent blood except that of the members of the church, that these 2 orders were made the ministers of his vengeance and the instruments of an intolerable tyranny, which he had established over his people and which he was about to extend over the neighboring country. The people affected to believe that this, with this power in the hands of an unscrupulous leader, there was no safety for the lives or property of any who should oppose him. They affected likewise to believe that Smith inculcated the legality of perjury or any other crime in defense or to advance the interest of the true believers, and that himself had set them the example by swearing to a false accusation against a certain person for the crime of murder. It was likewise asserted to be a fundamental article of the Mormon faith that God had given the world all it contained to them as his saints, that they secretly believed in their right to all the goodly lands, farms, and property in the country, that consequently there was no moral offense anticipating God's good time to put them in possession of stealing. If opportunity offered, that in fact, the whole church was a community of murderers, thieves, robbers, and outlaws, that Joseph Smith had established a bogus factory in Nauvoo for the manufacture of counterfeit money, and that he had maintained about his person a tribe of swindlers, bootlegs, and counterfeiters to make it, put it into circulation. He goes on and talks actually about polygamy and that. But in this, though, he then says, you know, these really sound exaggerated. And I think there's probably been a tendency of blaming the Mormons, as Roger Lanius and John Hollis said, that, you know, it was easy to also commit crimes if you were a thief that had no affiliation with Mormonism, but blame it on the Mormons because you could then, you know, you pretty well got away with it too. So it's not, you know, so the point is that Ford is actually very tempered in this statement, the whole statement, even though what I read is quite inflammatory. You know, he gives, as a matter of fact, here's what he says. I want to read this. He says, It was a fact also that some larcenies and robberies had been committed and the Mormons had been convicted of the crimes, and that other larcenies had been committed by persons unknown but suspected to be Mormons. Justice, however, requires me here to say that I have investigated the charge of promiscuous stealing and find it to be greatly exaggerated. It is probable, however, that the Mormons sometimes erred in protecting members of their community from prosecution and punishment who were accused of offenses under a belief that the accusations against them was a persecution of their enemies on account of their religion. So he's very tempered in this, you know, and it's actually quite an amazing statement of how tempered he is in this whole thing. Now, what's interesting, in October 30th, 1845, Ford writes a letter he received four, I believe it was four letters, two of them from George Miller, one from Stephen, from Orson, no, I'm sorry, Orson, Orson Spencer, who was, I think he was involved in the University of Nauvoo at the time. And matter of fact, his was so bad, Orson Spencer's was so bad that Ford wrote a couple of sentences back because it was just so poorly done. But George Miller's letter, he said that clearly it was a better written letter and more thoughtful. And I think the tone change of Ford is fascinating. You know, this is only maybe a year, year and a half later, at least a year and a half. I mean, it could be upwards of two, I guess. Secondly, although the sheriff had put down the house burners, the Mormons go, I guess burning all the houses down, we got to stop doing that. So anyway, he says, he had not suppressed stealing and murder on the other side. So what he's saying is that the sheriff had stopped the Mormons from burning the non-Mormons' houses, but he hadn't suppressed any of the stealing or the murder. He said, one man had certainly been murdered between Carthage and Appanoos. Another was missing in Nauvoo under circumstances which leave no doubt but that he was murdered in your city, and most probably by order of some of your principal men. He does go on. I'm sorry. At least such is and was the popular belief. Stolen property has been traced to your city during the ascendancy of the sheriff, and the owners who came to search were ordered away and fled for fear of their lives. None of the stolen property could be found, and in fact, the owners did not dare to go to look for it without the aid and protection of state troops. You may say this is the work of only a few, and that your people are not responsible for the few in your city any more than in any other city. This may be true, but its truth does not do away with the necessity of a military force. I have long believed that there were those in Nauvoo who carry on a pretty large business in stealing. So his opinion has changed by that point, that that stealing in Nauvoo was much larger than he had realized. It had become much worse, or it was much worse. And I'm saying that he's now learned that it was way worse than he had thought in late 43 or early 44, and which Smith was in charge of that.
Wow, that is something else.
It is.
Yeah, you've given us a lot, like from the documents too. So it's hard to deny that, you know, this organized crime thing that we're talking about. What, before we let you go, what else do you think people should know about this subject?
Well, I wanted to delve into somebody who I see is very much a moderate and a believing moderate at that. And that would be Community of Christ Church former church historian Mark Scherer. If you've met Mark, and I'm talking to your audience because I'm pretty sure you have, but if you met Mark, you're going to be quite impressed at how moderate he is. He is careful. He is thoughtful. I can't emphasize that enough. So I thought, let's see what Mark has to say. Now, this is about the Missouri period, okay? But he said, this is after he quotes some of a speech that Joseph Smith gave on October 15th. This is Monday, October 15th. And he said, later in the speech, the prophet provided his troop a veiled authorization to pillage and plunder the countryside. Now, that's Mark Scherer's words in the official Community of Christ. It's got Community of Christ Seminary Press as the publisher. It's got his name on the book, and this is their official history. And like I say, this is a very moderate, very careful historian. The final thing, and then again, bringing us back around to being careful when it comes to these, my friend Mike Marquardt loves to say, when we come across uncomfortable history, he said, and let's say Sarah, let's use Sarah Pratt as an example. Sarah Pratt was there. We aren't. She saw what happened. And until, you know, we can say that we got something better, we got to trust Sarah Pratt. So anyway, but here to show you, you know, this is for the audience again, how there can be contradictory statement. This comes from D. Michael Quinn, which, by the way, I would agree with you that documents should have been D instead of Dennis. But anyway, but we can blame his mom for that, right? So Mike writes this in Origins of Power. He says, James Bracken, also a devout Mormon, acknowledged that during 1838, some of the brethren did things they should not have done, such as appropriating to their own use things that did not belong to them. He noted that Joseph Smith had not authorized such stealing. Bracken may not have been a Danite, but Justice Morris was and had listened to Smith authorize a Danite meeting apparently after the Gallatin fight to suck the milk of the Gentiles. Morris, who remained loyal to the prophet throughout his life, added that Smith explained that we had been injured by the mob in Missouri, and to take from the Gentiles was no sin, merely retribution. The Mormon prophet had unleashed the fury of the Danites by his published endorsement of taking vengeance in the event of hostilities, and by his private instructions for the Danites to suck the milk of the Gentiles. So you've got two very, you know, contradictory statements right there in one paragraph that Mike cites. But if you read Bill Shepherd's papers, you're going to come away with a very different feeling.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for spending time. I know you're very busy with life, so thanks for giving our audience some really kind of disturbing but compelling stuff to think about. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. You're so kind to even allow me. I love this podcast, and I feel lucky that you even asked me.
was good enough for my grandpa. It was good enough for my grandpa. That was good enough for my grandpa. That's good enough for me.
It's with that backdrop that we bring you more into the culture of thievery that starts in Nauvoo. Let's talk about the Monmouth Five. Oh, they're not a terribly named boy band of subpar musicians, but they were a terribly named boy band of thieves. It all starts with a Mormon summer and the stake in Ramus, Illinois in 1841. Within the stake was a group of notorious thieves running their own kind of Gadiant and robber operation.
The group was made up of several members of the stake who would swear secret oaths, steal from the Gentiles, lie and fake promises to get people to convert, drink, and other shenanigans. And I just have to say, this becomes a culture. So because of the Missouri days, this culture of like Danite culture are carried on in branches and wards. This is how the priesthood was operating. And I know a lot of people aren't gonna like me saying that, but the temple had secret oaths and handshakes. To them, this was a sign of righteousness. And so this carries out into small like meta ways. So in this particular place, these secret oaths and stuff got bad enough that Bishop Williams Whiteman and his first counselor, Joseph Holbrook, were heavily involved. So the stake president, Joel Hills Johnson, didn't know how to control these dudes because their secret oaths and shenanigans are bringing trouble on the whole branch. So by the fall of 1841, they jailed five members of the stake in Monmouth, Illinois for stealing. And this is where the Monmouth Five get their name.
So at this point, remember, Brigham Young is still an apostle. So he and Willard Richard showed up in November to conduct a church trial. This thievy boy band was excommunicated from the church. Your lineup? Joseph Holbrook, Alanson Brown, Finley Page, William H. Edwards, and Joseph Telford. And then two other guys were also axed for assisting them. As the investigation unfolds, Hiram Smith actually has to become involved. They decided it was so bad they had to cut off the entire stake. Kind of a Lorena Bobbitt move. So the whole stake is discontinued. They turn it into a branch. Then there's a decision of reparations where the newly formed branch had to dedicate $1,000 worth of wagons, horses, and other supplies that would go towards the Nauvoo temple construction.
Yes, that's right. You heard right. It shows that thousands of dollars of things were stolen by these Mormon thieves from the Gentiles living nearby. And so the reparations were not to give the property back to those who were the victims of the theft, but the thieves had to turn their supplies over to fund the building of the temple. I just love it when temple fund is confiscated crime money. That's fun.
This does not set up a great precedent, right? You can steal, and that's naughty, but we will accept your booty as tithing and then excommunicate you, but then we'll bring you back in soon. So to make a public showing of their penance, the trials of these thieves were printed publicly in the Times and Seasons, stating that the Mormon leadership, who remember at that point includes Babes in Toyland villain John C. Bennett, did not condone the stealing. No worries though, because the Monmouth Five moved out of town for a few months till everyone kind of forgot about it, and then they were brought back and rebaptized. And then, of course, their contributions of the loot helps to build the nice shiny temple.
Stealing was rampant in Nauvoo, and you can find lots of ink dedicated to public newspapers about the crimes. Hiram Smith even had two buddies staying in his house, David Holdman and James Dunn, who were so into stealing from Gentiles that Hiram had to kick them out to distance himself from them. I mean, he still liked them, but he had to get rid of them. If you pay attention to the newspapers and conference talks, it's a real problem. And why? Well, it's this Danite culture I'm talking about.
During the Missouri period, which sadly kind of doesn't exist on our podcast, the Mormon secret police, the Danites, developed a culture of stealing from any non-Mormon or Gentile. Historian Bill Shepard concluded that the attitude during Missouri of swiping stuff from non-Mormons was, quote, alive and well in the hearts of a considerable number of Mormons. So all they need now is a new target. They pivot to their new neighbors in Illinois or Iowa. But Bill kind of muddies the waters a little by pointing out that while some of these dudes had been big bad Danites in Missouri, a lot of them hadn't. Also, some of them are loyal, faithful church members, while some of the others just kind of hide under the Mormon umbrella as a cover. And their motivations were also spread along the spectrum. Some are just swipey because that's what they do. Others would resort to it just out of desperation. Yet another class of them just really wants revenge on Gentiles, whether that's due to real offenses or more of the imaginary kind.
So it reminds me of now, you know, like we're going right now in 2023, when we're recording this, we're going through this Tim Ballard thing, but it's always some scandal, some Mormon crook, some Mormon MLM or whatever. And I think it was the same thing back then, only really amplified, because it would get, like, you would pay the price for your neighbors. And it comes from this culture of Danite stealing. And we joke about skipping over the Missouri period, but really we've actually dedicated a lot of talk about it. And you can go back and listen to us talk about Danite culture, but really, it really was about secret oaths. The idea that you could, you know, take anything from the Gentiles for God's purpose. And it was reparations for how, you know, they persecuted you or whatever. There was really a lot of justification. And again, it's acting as priesthood at this point. So these men think that they're acting in the name of God, and this is a noble act. In their minds, I'm sure that they are sort of these like righteous pirates for God. And that happens, and it starts spreading out into local wards. And we're going to see it carry through till today. I mean, I know fundamentalist sects today, so a few of them, not all of them, but some of them act like this. They play spy shit. They act like kids. They think that spying on people and stealing from people and committing fraud is like kind of a cool outlaw move. And where would they get this from? From our beloved pioneers.
And again, back to the exceptionalism that's rampant. This is obviously not new or unique. I mean, this is just religious flavored, the ends justify the means. But it is interesting in this context.
Well, I think that's it. Like, it was a Wild West, and Mormons were some of the roughest people on the frontier. I mean, again, as they're coming to Utah, people are terrified of Mormons, and they're terrified of them for a reason. They're like a gang to people. They're a scary gang of people. And so I think the thing that I still just kind of blows my mind growing up this way and hearing these stories is, like, we really were taught they were like these pious, sweet, you know, people.
Persecuted.
And persecuted. And of course, some are. It's like everything else. But really, again, it was, the Mormons were rough and tumble. This was wild, wild west stuff.
So this culture of stealing becomes one of the main complaints that people had about Mormons. Not only do you have the rumors of secret polygamy, counterfeiting, land speculation, voting in block, you just insert your complaint here. The main issue that a lot of citizens had around Mormons was their cattle and stuff suddenly goes missing. And this in Nauvoo would lead to the infamous 1844 wolf hunt, where non-Mormon militias wanted to hunt wolves, aka Mormons, who were stealing, and kill them. Governor Thomas Ford steps in with 200 men to stop the wolf hunt, but it doesn't stop the anger of the Gentiles, doesn't stop the death of Joseph Smith and his friends, it also didn't stop stealing. Actually, anything but that.
Sweet high, sweet low.
If you comb through the non-Mormon newspaper, the Warsaw Signal, at the time after Joseph Smith's death, you'll see many articles about Mormon thieves. Headlines of Mormon stealing things were ubiquitous. The article cites the Mormon Doctrine and Covenants, section 64, 27 through 28, which reads, quote, "Behold, it is said in my laws, or forbidden, to get in debt to thine enemies, but behold, it is not said at any time that the Lord should not take when he please and pay as seemeth him good." And this is like what, you know, the Gentiles are like, it's in their scriptures. It's saying that they can justify it. And they're right. It's in the scriptures.
So what are they stealing at this time? Here's one example from the non-Mormon community in Montebello, which is just kind of down the river from Nauvoo. So when the guys down there put their green visors on, sharpen their vintage pencils, they guess that Mormon thieves had taken about $1,300 worth of cows, hogs, sheep, apples, bees, honey, potatoes, logs, fences, pies, bacon, etc. I really liked pies. That was a good inclusion there. And, you know, I for one expected better conduct from the fighting mosquitoes.
They were stealing all the bacon, but not stealing hearts. This is a huge part of why there's such hatred of the Mormons living in Nauvoo, and it leads to their expulsion. In fact, in 1845, as they know tensions are mounting and they might go to war, things just keep getting worse. Four Mormon dudes, Artemus Johnson, Thomas Brown, William and Stephen Hodges, lead a stealing expedition in West Point in Iowa Territory. And they go off, you know, on this secret mission, and as they're trying to rob the farms there, they got into a struggle with the Mennonites, John Miller and Henry Lisi, who were protecting their property. First of all, who fights a Mennonite? Come on, guys. And as they're fighting, Gentile John Miller was murdered.
And this will rain down a lot of hurt on the Mormons as Iowa officials start investigating the murder. The men go into hiding as a result. Brigham Young refused to shelter them in Nauvoo, and they threatened to kill Brigham Young if he didn't. So to his credit, they do turn them over to the Iowa officials to be arrested. But the Nauvoo neighbor prints a bit of a lie by saying that these four guys were never Mormons. It's a really terrible attempt to distance themselves from the drama. But the statement didn't work because they were, of course, Mormon elders, and William Hodges had actually preached a sermon right before he participated in this murder. Two of the men would pay for the crime, the Hodges brothers. It said during their execution, Stephen Hodges told the crowd watching his hanging that they were being put to death simply because they're Mormons. They were being discriminated against.
The reason why this action was considered Mormon sanction is complex. Part of it had to do with the fact that it seems that some Danite oaths were taken, and once broken, death was the punishment, and there were lots of threats of death here, like killing Brigham Young, he's going to turn them in, blah, blah, blah. The other thing is the lawyers for the Hodges brothers were paid for by Bill Hickman. You might remember his name. He's Brigham Young's henchman. The lawyers were paid by Bill Hickman, Return Jackson Redden, which is kind of an awesome name. Return Jackson Redden. Return him. And by Joseph Smith Jr.'s brother-in-law, William J. Salisbury, who married Joseph Smith's sister. And so this indicates that this was actually a Danite-sanctioned action.
And we should point out here, too, that our friend Marianne Clements, who we've had on a couple times, has also been working on this stuff. And guys like this Return Jackson Redden, really interesting guys who have these fascinating connections to Mormonism. Sometimes it's just family members. Sometimes they are partially involved. But this whole culture and network is super, super interesting.
Again, doesn't it remind you of Now?
Now, yeah.
Like networks. I remember growing up, there's this apocryphal story. My family, were very, very righteous. But I remember them telling this story about how their Mormon bishop swindled everyone in the ward out of their money. And my family was led to poverty because of it. It's a story we heard a lot. And I think this had to have been happening all the time.
Yep. And according to Bill Shepard, all of this is further backed up by this example. Quote, John Walker testified at the trial of the Hodges brothers that shortly before the assault on Miller and Lizzie, he asked William how many other criminals from Nauvoo were in their gang. William's response was, there was a good many. Said when one got into a scrape, they would help one get the other out. If they could not one way, they would another. If any of the company ever told anything, that he or the balance would kill him. If ever I told any of the conversation, they would kill me.
Artemus Johnson escaped prosecution and became a member of Brigham Young's first company of pioneers, even receiving a patriarchal blessing from Brother Brigham himself later on. He also served a mission in 1847 for the church, so Mormons trying to pretend like these guys weren't on their team was more of an effort to throw them under the bus once they got caught.
The other guy that got out of prosecution, Tom Brown, was pissed the Brethren didn't back him up after the theft. He claimed the Brethren asked him to do it, and poisony chief of police, Hosea Stout, wrote on February 12, 1847, "Today I learned and reported to Brigham that Tom Brown was threatening the lives of the 12. Strangely, after that happened, Tom Brown didn't live very long. He was accidentally shot and died in winter quarters. Porter Rockwell was, not too surprisingly, involved in this accident. According to Bill Shepard, Brigham Young angrily declared, Brown's old shoes were worth more than the whole body of the man who killed him.
But he won the Wasters and Destroyers contest of last episode. Fair and square. How could he say such a thing? So while the trial for the Slefton murder was happening, some of the witnesses had fled jurisdiction and they were gone on another stealing expedition in Rock Island, Illinois. And during this botched robbery, another dude was killed, Colonel George Davenport. And again, Bill Shepard cites, quote, during the trial, Robert H. Birch, one of the accused murderers, testified the robbery was planned, quote, in Joseph Smith's old council chamber in Nauvoo. He added that conspirators included Judge Fox, Aaron Long, John Long, Return Jackson Redden, Orrin Porter Rockwell, an unidentified Hodge brother, and others. Aaron Long and John Long and another gang member named Granville Young were hanged for murdering Davenport. I'm a jumping in. Now, we aren't even getting into all the other murdery things happening at this time, so I'll link to Bill Shepard's article that talks a lot about a bunch of the murders Mormon men committed against Gentiles after Joseph Smith's death. I'd say it was a fun read, but it's actually a really hard, disgusting read. Several Mormon critics go missing, lots of intrigue and deceit, and the Quorum of the Twelve are all involved, and it's quite the story. But we're going to focus on stealing today, not murder. So you'll have to read Bill Shepard's article in the show notes for all the murdery stuff.
Or Hosea Stout's diaries.
Or John D. Lee's diaries.
Or Bill Hickman's memoir. But we digress.
Back to thieving.
Now, of course, during the war at Nauvoo and right before the Mormons leave, there's a lot of theft on both sides of the faith divide. More and more escalation. Again, Shepard's article will catch up to speed, but it doesn't stop after they left Nauvoo.
I mean, squatting illegally on Omaha lands might be considered stealing, but people still don't think that seems to count for some reason.
As we've previously discussed, during the winter quarters period, there's a lot of theft there as well. People even get cut off from the church in high council meetings for it.
And again, before anyone tells us this was just the way things were back then, I mean, we did say that it was the Old West, so I kind of said that as well. Remember that even members of the church didn't like this practice, so like back then, like now, people didn't like stealing. It's crazy. Brigham Young's brother, Joseph Young, who was the president of the 70, was very frustrated by the crime, and he said in an 1846 meeting, quote, "There are brethren in these quorums and even presidents who are connected with a body of those consecrating thieves." I love that he said consecrating thieves. That shows that it's like, you know, a ritual for them. "Who pretend to say they have a right to consecrate from the Gentiles, but such will steal from their brethren as well as others." Allenson Brown testified in a case that there were about 200 Mormon thieves during this time operating in a somewhat organized fashion. And, you know, Joseph Young's statement seemed to back that up.
Several other elders agreed with Joseph Young, but in a move that will surprise nobody, John D. Lee stepped up to say the brethren, quote, "were probably too hasty in their determination to rid the Quorum of Thieves." He told them they were all overreacting and said, quote, "that did the elders possess the power of Jehovah in their present weak condition, in less than 24 hours the earth would be depopulated, especially should the elders be vested with that power in turns, for what would be spared by one would likely be destroyed by another." Very convenient rhetoric for that man, for sure. After Lee gave a speech, Young agreed he'd been too hard on everyone and agreed to be more charitable to the thieves among them and to not blast their characters.
Very Christ-like.
As for Thomas Williams, the Picasso of stealing, we talked about earlier at the top of the episode, you know, Thomas Williams that was said to be so good at stealing, he made an art of it. He became one of the first prosperous merchants in Salt Lake and is also a very successful Mormon lawyer. And here's what our good friend Connell O'Donovan said of him, quote, "There was a network of Southern-born LDS slave owners in Salt Lake in the 1850s that seemed periodically to sell each other their slaves and or live near each other or have joint business ventures. This consisted of Williams Washington Camp, Thomas S. Williams, William Henry Hooper, and J.H. Johnson. These men, although holding some lofty titles, were not very scrupulous. Camp and Williams were often excommunicated and rebaptized for their immoral and unethical business and personal relationships. They were solidly middle-class men with aspirations."
Actually, I love it when we can quote Connell stuff because it's always super interesting, and he has so much great stuff about him. So I want to dive into his life a little bit more because, again, as we think of the doctrine and theologies that you agonize over to be obedient to when you're a faithful member, when you think you're not perfect and can never measure up, just remember what types of folks were helping shape these doctrines. I want you to keep that in your mind, and that's why we bring it up. Brigham Young cheerfully ran with these characters and often invented doctrine with them, and there were thieves and criminals in the whole group. So, you know, when you're feeling bad about stuff, maybe give yourself a little break. Okay, lecture over and back to Connell's work about Thomas S. Williams.
Connell has found that Thomas Stephen Williams was born in 1827 in Tennessee. His family joins the Mormons in 1836. Then, when Thomas is about 9, he's baptized at Hans Mill. His father Alexander was a night guard, and he would stand watch protecting the Mormons at the mill. Then, when Thomas is 15, he impregnates a 16-year-old Mormon girl named Albina Merrill. So the two were married in Nauvoo in 1842, and they would go on to have 11 kids together.
Thomas soon married plurally and had another child with one of his two other polygamous wives. It's in Nauvoo that Connell says Williams really starts developing a reputation as a proper thief. The apocryphal story that really gets him some Mormon credit is when he was 16 and he secretly raided a non-Mormon sawmill and stole all the machinery from it and then sank it in the Mississippi River where no one ever found it. Like, I wonder, you know, is that like an ox in the mire Sabbath breaking activity, or is that like a Sabbath sanctioned?
Sawmill in the river. That's a good
pretty good Sunday activity. Yeah.
So these kind of skills were just the right fit for the Nauvoo police. And at age 19, Thomas joined up. It's also rumored that he was a Danite, likely one of that 200 den of thieves we talked about earlier. His Mormon cred also has him serving in the Mormon battalion as sergeant in the Higgins detachment. His wife, Albina, was one of the women that came with the battalion as a washerwoman. Hopefully she didn't have a fancy tub she liked, and they brought their children with them.
Here's what Connell says, quote, "The detachment arrived in Pueblo, Colorado on November 17, 1846, and wintered there with the Mississippi Company and their group of slaves. The combined Sick Detachment and Mississippi Company then moved north to the spring to Fort Bridger to meet up with Young's Pioneer Company on their way to California, Utah. While at Fort Bridger, Williams stole a horse from a non-Mormon trader and made a present of it to Brigham Young. Young figured out what happened, and after Sergeant Williams left Fort Bridger, Young quietly returned the horse to its rightful owner. Young had ordered Sergeant Williams to leave the fort with both the Sick Detachment and the Mississippi Company to continue their westward migration. This ragtag group of ailing soldiers and weary Southerners entered the Salt Lake Valley on July 29, 1847, 5 days behind Young and the main company of pioneers. Once in Utah, Thomas Williams was involved in various skirmishes with Indians," end quote.
So when he gets to Utah, Williams goes into business with William Henry Hooper. Both of these men would become prominent slave owners in Utah, and they operated a popular general store called Hooper and Williams. It's like Hooper's store on Sesame Street, just with some enslavement on top. And it's here that Williams marries another plural wife, the daughter of W.W. Phelps. The day after she turned 16, Lydia Phelps married the notorious thief. Their marriage didn't last long, but they did have a child together. Williams ran several businesses, but in 1854, he sued Brigham Young, claiming he had given money as a loan to the territorial legislature, and it was never paid back. That sounds about right. And this lawsuit would damage the relationship between him and Brigham Young from there on out.
By 1856, it seems that William had lost his faith in the leadership. He tried to take a group of Mormon explorers to settle Colorado, and Heber C. Kimball denounced him right over the pulpit.
He's a fly turd.
He eventually left with the group to California and was excommunicated for leaving Deseret. Back to Connell, quote, "A month later, Williams and Judge George P. Stiles, who had recently been excommunicated on trumped-up charges, had their law offices broken into by returned missionary, now Salt Lake Sheriff, the alcoholic James Ferguson and his men, who dumped the legal papers of Thomas Williams and Judge Stiles into a latrine and set them on fire, literally igniting the Utah War in a latrine." Like the symbolism, like you can't make this up.
It's the poop papers.
Finally, in February of 1857, Young issued a full pardon to the group of men and they were rebaptized. How nice. However, Williams was becoming less willing to believe in Young's prophetic claims, and he decided to try to move his family out of state to get away from the rigid theocracy of the Reformation. But the day before his planned departure, 18-year-old David P. Kimball, who had just recently committed incredibly moving acts of heroism in rescuing members of the Martin Handcart Company, eloped with Thomas's 14-year-old daughter, Caroline. And this happened when a group of young Mormon boys on horses swooped into the Williams yard, grabbed Caroline, and spirited her away to Antelope Island, where the young girl's marriage was solemnized by
Warren Jeffs.
No.
This is word for word out of his playbook.
I'm serious. And it's
gee, where did he come up with this idea?
Kidnap her and take her to Antelope Island. No, it wasn't Warren Jeffs. You know who it was? Old Heber C. Kimball. And this happened where Williams could not find them. Horrified by this event and threatening to kill Heber C. Kimball for his participation in this bizarre marriage, Williams left Utah anyway the following day in a large company of apostates, including the aforementioned Judge Stiles and City Marshal P.K. Dotson, who were all fleeing from Mormon tyranny. tyranny. The large company banded together for protection against Mormon vigilantes, fueled by the rhetoric of the Reformation. However, Williams's wife refused to go with him and leave their newlywed daughter alone, so Thomas Williams left the valley without his family, and he only stayed away from Deseret for a year before deciding to return to his family. And within a few weeks of his return, Williams bought the 22-year-old slave Dan from Williams W. Camp, and by the following year, he had also bought two, quote, ebony bells, one 21 and of mixed race and the other 29 and of full African ancestry. But Connell never was able to discover their names.
Thanks to the work of Amy Tanner Theriot, we now know they were named Caroline and Tampion Hoy.
Good job. Nice work.
I read that and I thought, I'm going to go just see what Amy has to say. And sure enough, she figured it out. Amy is extremely sharp. I feel like her and Marianne shared DNA. They strike me as having the same detective
skills. Just finding good stuff.
Yeah. The details. So these two enslaved women will come into play with the Thomas Coleman murder, which we'll talk about later.
We did talk about it a little bit on the Mormon Stories interview we did. But yeah, these are the two women that sort of spark Thomas Coleman's murder, eventual murder.
Well, as for Mr. Thomas S. Williams, he is killed, allegedly by Indians, in 1860, and the two slaves were divided among his plural wives as part of his estate. Yuck.
But the crazy story of his family doesn't end there. Albina, the first wife and widow of Williams, was apparently sexually assaulted or accosted soon after his death by the new territorial governor, John W. Dawson. And he was a non-Mormon appointee that had been in the GSL for maybe 2 weeks when, he allegedly made grossly improper proposals to Albina Merrill Williams. And reports circulated that she had thrashed him soundly with a fire shovel in response, and he had then offered her $3,000 for her silence, but she rebuked him. And I should say she had had a baby 3 weeks earlier when he does this to her. In fact, she sent an affidavit describing his outrageous behavior to Washington, D.C., quote, where it would cause a minor sensation in the U.S. Senate. On January 1st, 1861, Governor Dawson surreptitiously abandoned Salt Lake City after only 3 weeks in office, taking the mail stage eastward in refuge. Unfortunately, seven Mormon vigilantes in their 20s, Woodward Reynolds, Lot Elisha Huntington, Isaac Niebuhr, Moroni Clausen, and three Luce brothers, Jason Reed, John Matthew, and Wilford Woodruff Luce, caught up with the retreating governor at Ephraim Hanks's Pony Express station at Mountain Dell. And these seven young men were all members of William Wild Bill Hickman's gang of marauders called the Hounds, or Hickman's Hounds.
Connell states, quote, Ephraim Hanks promised Dawson that he was safe there, and the young Mormons initially acted friendly toward Dawson. However, after a night of drinking, the seven drunken youths waited until Dawson went outside alone. Dawson discovered that someone had plundered some of his baggage, including a valuable beaver robe. Moroni Clausen accosted him insolently at that point and then struck the governor to the ground. Jason Luce and Reynolds, aided some by the other youths, brutally beat Dawson nearly to death, kicking and beating him about the head, chest, and groin, and cut off one of his testicles by some reports. That's an old Warren Snow treatment there. Fearful that Salt Lake would be seen as utterly out of government control, the Salt Lake Sheriff James Ferguson and his deputies began rounding up the perpetrators. Jason Luce, Wood Reynolds, and a third unnamed boy were caught right away, but the other three, Lot Huntington, Moroni Clausen, and one other, escaped temporarily. On the 12th, Porter Rockwell killed Lot Huntington at Fish Springs near Tooele and captured the other two boys. Once they got to Salt Lake, the two young men made a break and were shot down on 2nd South Street on the morning of January 17th, 1862.
These are just a few of the featured miscreants and scoundrels that gave Mormons a bad reputation. But again, we bring this to you to remember that now, like then, there were some bad dudes carrying the banner of saints. It was a rough and wild time, and just because someone was a fellow Mormon didn't mean they wouldn't steal your horse or your sawmill.
Lost sounds rumble in the heavens, look down at the end of the world. Junkie for words, hold on to something, make some noise, it's the silence of earth. Reaching for a dream, the stereo.
We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't take our trips on LSD. We don't burn our draft cards down on Main Street, because we like living right and getting the Book of Mormon's report. powered by Benchmark Books. It's time for another one of our famous combo plates tonight. First, a book that we sadly neglected to pitch during the heady days of Nauvoo, Cultures in Conflict, a documentary history of the Mormon War in Illinois by John Hallwas and RLDS historian extraordinaire Roger Lanius. This is a really good study of the craziness that's based on primary sources. Now, on to the articles. First, Bill Shepard stealing at Mormon Nauvoo from the JWHA Journal. As usual, Bill likes to poke his nose into entertaining rabbit holes. Finally, Connell O'Donovan's Let This Be a Warning to All N-Words, The Life and Murder of Thomas Coleman in Theocratic Utah. This exists solely on Connell's site, like a lot of his work, so go check it out. Connell brings his blend of historian hat and genealogist hat to the task and always wears them well. As usual, get these and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.